1-844-945-9455 with your contribution of $120, or go online at willpledge.org and make your contribution there. Jay Pierce, final word.
Yeah, got a pledge from Monticello in, so we are up to 140 overall.
Thank you.
Want to get 10 more, because we do want to be halfway as soon as we can to our 300 goal for this three-day mini drive. And don't forget, when you call 244-9455 or you log on to willpledge.org, not only are you helping to support a service that you value and use, that thousands of others value and use every day, but the Common Ground Food Co-op will be giving to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank enough to provide six meals. That's enough to feed two adults for a day. That's for every pledge at 244-9455 or willpledge.org. Together, we're coming together, and we're doing some great stuff in the community.
You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. In the studio, Focus host David Inge.
Hi, Dave.
Hour one, sir.
Hour one, we will be inviting comments on the programs that people hear on our station. We have here in the studio with us Kate Dobrovolny. She's our station manager. Mark Lennon, he's our general manager. Jay Pierce will be here. He's our director of created content. This is something that we on occasion try to do to give them an opportunity to talk about what is happening here at the station, and then also for people who are listening to ask questions and make comments. That's what we're doing. And then I do also want to mention that in the second hour, we'll be having the second installment of a special series that we're doing to mark the 30th anniversary of this show. We have an archive that people can access on the web, but we also have a lot of past recordings of past programs that aren't on the web archive and have not been heard in a very long time. And I thought, well, it'd be interesting to go back and to pull some of those programs and to look at what we were talking about in some cases, as many as 20 years ago, and see what we said about it then. And in many cases, we're saying the same things, that things haven't changed. So what you'll be hearing in the second hour, an interview that I did in 1991 with E.J. Dionne, who is now a regular commentator on politics for National Public Radio, and also from 1999, a conversation that Jack Brighton had with Deborah Tannen. She is a scholar that is very well known for writing about miscommunication. And they talked in 1999 about a book that she's written that's titled The Argument Culture. So this show, these shows, both of them, are all about how it is we think about and talk about politics. So that's what we have up for this morning.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
And we certainly are looking for comments on programming this morning. What we're also looking for is some support for the station. This is a day two of a mini-drive that we are having here, encouraging people to make a call or go online and pledge some of their money to WILL. And Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me, and I'm really pleased that he could be here with me this hour, both because he is the guy that is now really heading up our web operation, but also because he has had a very long association with this show. We like to call him our producer emeritus because he was the producer for many years, and also has hosted the program. And so you'll be hearing an interview that he did in the 11 o'clock hour.
Well, thank you, David. It's such a pleasure to be on the show. I've always loved the show. 30 years on the air. Can you believe that?
No.
It is truly a treasure to our community. 30 years is something special, actually, in public radio or anything in life, actually. I love the show. I support the show. I hope that you listening to the show also support it. We're here to ask for your contribution during our mini pledge drive. You can do that by simply calling 217-244-9455 with your pledge to support Focus 580 and all the programs you hear on WILL. We need to hear from you. Certainly during this pledge drive, we have a special opportunity also to support the Eastern Illinois Food Bank in conjunction with supporting WILL. So basically every pledge, basic pledge that you call in, Common Ground Food Co-op has basically agreed to donate the cost of six meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. If that isn't an incredible bargain, I don't know what is. You can support your favorite radio station and also provide food for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, and all you have to do is make a pledge call right now, 244-9455.
All right. And if you would like to make a comment ask a question, have something to say about the programs we have on our stations. This is your opportunity to do it. As I said, our three guests here in the studio, our general manager, Mark Leonard, our station manager, Kate Dobrovolny, and our director of created content, Jay Pierce. Whatever you have to say, maybe you have some thoughts on things we might do with the service to make it better. Maybe you'd like to call in and say there's something you like. You'd like to call in and say there's something you don't. Any and all of those kind of comments are great. So here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to write us an email, you can do that too. The address is will-talk. Got to get the dash in there. will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll get as many as we can. As soon as we start getting people, we'll get them in. Thanks to you guys very much for being here. I don't know if there's anything in particular that you would like to start with.
News from AP that's coming over that Egypt's vice president says Hosni Mubarak has resigned as president and handed control to the military.
Wow.
So.
All right. That's very interesting. Yes, indeed. Car horns were heard around Cairo in celebration after the vice president, Omar Suleiman, made the announcement on national TV on Friday. He apparently said in these difficult circumstances that the country is passing through, President Hosni Mubarak has decided to leave the position of the presidency.
Yeah. And Egypt's El Baradei is saying, it's the greatest day of my life. The country's been liberated, quote unquote.
So, that is a story that we will continue to follow. And we do have some callers here. I don't know, again, if you want to just go right to calls or there's anything in particular you want to say, talk about? Okay, well, we'll do calls then. We'll get right to the calls. And we'll start with Urbana and line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I don't want to seem hypercritical because I think the news on WILL is quantitatively better than anywhere else on television or radio. However, in recent days, there has been a frequently reported comment from a legislator in Chicago about the overpayment of retirement payments for university and state employees. And it sounds, from what is being reported, as though this is largesse from the state, that we're simply being paid huge sums out of the state treasury. It ignores the fact that we paid into that fund ourselves and the state matched it when they got around to it. And the payments we get as retirement are from that fund that has been accumulating and we hope drawing interest. That by and large, university employees are actually paid less than the going rate in private industry, and that we, among other reasons, took jobs with the university because of the retirement benefits. We also liked working for the university and find Urbana-Champaign a fine community to live in. But I think WILL could do a better job of reporting in putting this into context and not uncritically repeating what somebody has said.
Well, all right. I don't know if Jay in particular, you want to comment on that at all?
Well, I mean, I've heard exactly what you said, but... You know, I mean, it may have been on one newscast or two newscasts, but maybe we should repeat it more often and whenever we do have somebody critical of that, because we're all state employees and we're there with you in understanding that side of it. So I'll pass that along to Tom Rogers.
Yes, I think you would agree probably that you could make more in private industry, even though I assume you like working for public broadcasting well enough to want to be here.
Yeah, I personally haven't looked into it, so I don't know. But you know, that quite possibly could be. But I'll pass it along to Tom.
Yeah, so I'm sure Tom is listening.
That we're putting it in the context as often as we're reporting it. So, yeah, thanks a lot for pointing that out.
May I compliment WILL in general, though, it's virtually the only place I can find where there is essentially unbiased, trustworthy news. And I compliment you on that. Thank you.
Well, we'll go on to Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
I have three things I'd like to say. The first one is I don't understand why we take away local talent and have talent come in from Philadelphia. I'm talking about Terry Groth. I don't understand why we don't keep the talent we have here, which is wonderful, and let them do it. Why do we pay to have something coming in from another place? That's number one. Number two is I called in to get a pledge yesterday, been pledging since 1970s, and I got a person in South Carolina answering the phone. I said, wow. I said, well, at least you have a job. And she said, no, she was a volunteer. And I thought, why in the world am I talking to somebody? Because she asked me dumb questions like, what was my area code for my telephone number and stuff like that. Well, anybody here would know that. So it occurred to me she wasn't here, and she wasn't. And the third thing is, I wish you'd give more airtime to the platform for supporting public broadcasting in general. I haven't heard a – this is the first program I've heard that's – has anything to do with the broadcasting here, and I've called my senator, I've called everybody, I've called the White House about it. It's vital that we do something about it, and people need to wake up. I mean, 11% of the people supporting public television, public radio, and public broadcasting, and they were doing that when I started giving money. It was 10% back in the 70s. We need to do something better to spread our base, and I love the station, and I'm very, very supportive of it, but I really wish you'd not cut back David and Celeste in favor of somebody from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for your words, and I'll answer that because I was the one that made that decision. And that's putting fresh air in at 1 o'clock as opposed to Celeste in that hour. Last year, we had to lay off 9 people on our staff, and one of them was one of the producers for our talk shows. And we could not ask Harriet Williamson to produce 2 hours of Focus, that's 10 different, hours per week, 2 hours per day, and add 5 more hours, booking 5 more interviews for – we just couldn't do it because she is already working as hard as she can to take care of the research and the lining up of the guests and coordinating of schedules.
She does a wonderful job.
Yeah, she does. But
I'm not criticizing it. I just would like to have more.
Well, that's the answer. The answer is we had to lay off the position that was doing that, that was helping Harriet book Focus to let Harriet take care of the afternoon magazine. We had to reassign Harriet completely to Focus to cover that. And that's what happened. And Fresh Air is a very popular public radio show. A lot of people do like it. And
it's all right show, so, but I didn't, yeah. Comparison to what we have here,
I understand.
No better.
Totally understand what you're saying. And that was the rationale behind that. That's why that had to happen. And we do have Celeste sharing some of the hours with David on Focus now. So you will still hear Celeste from time to time. And, of course, in the noon hour, she's still doing some interviews, short interviews along with the other information in the noon hour. And she has some other duties at the stations now. She's able to call on her journalistic roots and, of course, her sensibilities. And she's working with our efforts of years talking about community conversations and how they help to inform the programs that you're hearing on the radio station, some of the topics and some of the news coverage. And we have this website we're building called We'll Connect to put pieces together.
Yeah. That's a very good idea.
Celeste is the editor of all of that and helping to get the multimedia on the website. And so she's moving into some new areas and doing an outstanding job. We were happy that we were able to call on her abilities and her dedication and have her help us out in those areas if we couldn't have that 1 hour a day in the interviews. Yeah.
I'll tell you what we're going to do. We've decided here, because we have breaking news events we'd like to be on top of in Egypt, that we're going to go to the BBC and carry that for a little while. And we might have – we'll see if we can – if we can't get back to it today, we'll get these guys in the studio again another day just as soon as we can, because my apologies, we have some people that we can't take, and we do want to – give people the opportunity to make comments, ask questions about the programming. So with that, I want to say thanks to the caller. Again, my apologies to people who are on hold. But right now we'll go to the BBC for live coverage of current events in Egypt.
I believe that all of that is gone. Now, it may turn out that they are deluded. Now, there are a couple of gunshots there as someone has his pistol into the air just a little way down the pavement here, again in celebration. They may prove to be misguided, but at the moment, tonight, they feel that this is it.
Paul Adams in Alexandria, thanks very much. The line's getting just a little bit broken up, but hopefully we'll come back to you later with a better line. In the meantime, the BBC Arabic service, Inez Ishmael, is here with me in the studio, and amazing pictures we're seeing on the screen here.
Amazing pictures, really. The sense of jubilation and the how the crowd has received this. It's an ending to this roller coaster of emotions, as we've been hearing, actually. But as Jonathan said, the questions are much more now. There are many more questions now. Will the parliament be resolved? Will there be a new constitution? What exactly will be the role of the army in this? Will the army only supervise a transition to a civilian government, or will the army want to have a bigger role in this? And in fact, the army is in a very sensitive situation. Some leaked reports, actually, from the U.S. cables show that Tantawi, the defense minister, is very, very keen on national security. This comes as number one to him, and that there are some voices in the army who are opposing to his policies of trying to ensure this. And this is a sign of the conflict that might be now going on inside the army, and that might cast some shadows also in the next phase, whether the army will take this country to a civilian government, or whether the army would want to have a bigger role in order, in their opinion, to secure the national unity and national security.
The BBC Arabic service, Inez Ishmael, here with me in the studio throughout this special world briefing. And just a reminder, it was within the last 20 minutes that the Egyptian Vice President Omar Suleiman read out the following words: "In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, citizens, in these difficult circumstances which the country is going through, President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from the post of President of the Republic and task the High Command of the Armed Forces with running the country's affairs." Well, we can go now to get some international reaction to Washington, to our State Department correspondent, Kim Kattas. Kim, did you see this yourself? Did you manage to catch this?
Yes, I'm at the State Department, where rather amazingly we have a feed of all international television stations streaming into our little offices where the media sits on the second floor of the State Department. And I've been watching it, of course, on the BBC, also monitoring Arabic TV stations. And I was, in fact, listening to Mr. Suleiman as he came on television and in Arabic in this very stern voice, announcing that President Mubarak had resigned and that he was handing over the reins of the country to the higher council of the military. This certainly was a very clear statement, because what we heard from President Mubarak yesterday left everybody very confused. And President Obama came out with a statement last night saying the Egyptian leadership had to clarify what it was doing. This had to be a credible transition, and it wasn't clear to the people of Egypt what was going on. So certainly this has made it very clear, but it still, as we've been hearing from our other colleagues, raises a lot of other questions. Does this now mean that Egypt is in the hands of the military? Will this be a credible transition? What happens to the leadership of Mr. Suleiman? I've been trying to get some reaction from American officials. They're still trying to decipher again what this means, the same way as they were trying to decipher what President Mubarak's statement meant yesterday. They feel that this is all leading, going into the right direction, that there is reason to feel that this is positive. But it is still possible that both the army and Mr. Suleiman will now try to consolidate whatever is left of the regime. If they feel that the departure of Mr. Mubarak could perhaps be enough to appease the protesters. It's quite tricky. We'll have to see how events unfold over the coming days. I think that neither the protesters nor Washington will be satisfied if that happens. They'll want to see real change take place. They'll want to see both Mrs. Suleiman and the army deliver credible reforms.
Kim Katas in Washington, and I believe we are expecting a statement from the president. I'm not sure if you've had any, if that news has filtered through to you yet.
I'm afraid I missed that question, but just to update you on what else I'm getting here from American officials, I'm monitoring incoming email feeds as well, and American officials are telling me that there is, as I was saying, the risk that Mr. Suleiman and Mr. Mubarak were looking for a way to save the regime overall, possibly by having President Mubarak say that he was standing down, appease the protesters, and then have the army and Mr. Suleiman consolidate the regime. But possibly what they're also trying to do is make sure that the army did not have to choose whether to take on or not the demonstrators. The longer this went on, the longer there was a risk that the army was going to have to protect the president, who is the commander-in-chief, from the protesters if the protesters had decided to take on the demonstrators. And we understand that President Obama will be making a statement here in Washington in about 2 hours.
Kim Katas in Washington, thanks very much. And I'm sure we'll get back to you once we have that statement. In the meantime, here in the studio, our diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. Jonathan, these are incredible pictures that we're seeing, as we were saying, flags waving, people jumping up and down. It's dark now in Egypt. It's definitely going to be a bit of a party, I imagine.
Oh, it's this is a historic day in the modern history of the country. I think what's fascinating, and we've talked a little bit about the questions that remain, the many questions within Egypt itself. Clearly, many of those questions are going to be being asked outside as well. The Americans have inevitably been behind the curve all the way through, and that, in a sense, you can't blame them. They have a limited ability to influence events in Egypt. They're going to be welcoming, clearly, what they hope will be the outbreak of democracy. No doubt they'll raise some concerns about the interim military rule and so on. But in private, they will be hugely concerned. This, remember, is an upheaval in their key ally in the Arab world, a country, Egypt, that is at the very centre of American efforts to try and build a coalition to contain Iran, a key ally of Israel, and very much part and parcel of the US policy towards containing Hamas in the Gaza Strip and so on. So the Americans will have huge concerns, I think, about what the future trajectory of Egypt's policy is going to be.
And we are expecting a statement from President Obama soon. Obviously, we'll bring that to you when it happens. But as you were saying, behind the curve the whole time, remind us what the US administration has been saying.
Well, look, the Americans have had a problem from the outset. I mean, there's an ambivalence in American policy towards not just Egypt, but to many other countries who are the West's allies in the region. You know, on the one hand, these are strong allies. Many of them are authoritarian regimes. They get strong backing from the West and from the Americans in particular, often military support, hardware, training and so on. Deep down, the Americans also have wanted, I think quite genuinely, to push for democracy in the region. Mr. Bush did it in his own particular way. Mr. Obama made his speeches in Cairo and in Istanbul, eager also to have the spread of democracy. But always there's been this underlying pragmatism. If the need to back an authoritarian state trumped in almost every case the need to try and promote democracy.
Our diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus here with me in the studio, as is our BBC Arabic service Inez Ishmael, and we're bringing you a special programme, a special world briefing as President Mubarak steps down.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International and made possible in part by the Medtronic Foundation, marking the 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act by recognizing nonprofit organizations like United Cerebral Palsy, dedicated to advancing the independence, productivity, and full citizenship of people with disabilities. Learn more at medtronicfoundation.org.
You're listening to live coverage from the BBC of today's news that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has stepped down. We'll continue to bring you live coverage from the BBC at least through 11 o'clock this morning. This is one of the ways that we are in touch with your world and your community. Give us a call to keep the support going for WILL AM 580. Our number is 217-244-9455, or online you can make a pledge at willpledge.org.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Claire Bowes, and after a summary of the latest world news, we'll be hearing more about the developments in Egypt, where the Vice President, Omar Suleiman, has announced that President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from office and his powers will be taken over by the Army Council. We'll hear from our correspondents in Cairo and more international reaction to the news. That's all here on the BBC World Service.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. Egypt's Vice President Omar Suleiman has announced on Egyptian television that President Hosni Mubarak has stepped down from office and his powers will be taken over by the Higher Council of the Armed Forces. The news is greeted with wild jubilation by the hundreds of thousands of protesters who have been on the streets in central Cairo for 18 days. They cheered loudly, waving their flags. Similar scenes of euphoria broke out in the city of Alexandria. The announcement followed news that President Mubarak had left Cairo for his residence in the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The takeover by the army leadership breaches the constitution, and the BBC Cairo correspondent says that it's not clear whether what looks increasingly like a military takeover will be sufficient for the protesters, who have been demanding a new civilian government. The Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi, who's in Zimbabwe, has urged Western countries to lift sanctions against Harare. The European Union and the US imposed sanctions on President Mugabe and some of his closest allies after elections in 2002. Aid agencies in Sudan say they expect as many as 800,000 people to move this year from the north to the south of the country, following a referendum on independence for southern Sudan. The UN Refugee Agency said that this would put pressure on the already fragile situation in the south. Nokia, the world's biggest manufacturer of mobile phones, has announced a long-term partnership with the software giant Microsoft. The Finnish and US companies are trying to stop Apple's iPhone and Google's Android platform from establishing an unassailable dominance in the increasingly important global smartphone market. The British government says the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, is reviewing some of the recently announced cuts to the BBC World Service. A senior foreign policy official has said options were being discussed. BBC News.
You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC World Service with a special programme following the news that President Hosni Mubarak is to step down. Well, we can go now to Jerusalem for some reaction from our correspondent there, Kevin Connolly. Kevin, it's all happened in the last half an hour. What reaction has filtered through to you?
Well, there's been no reaction so far from the Israeli government, and I wouldn't hold your breath waiting for any either, because nowhere is this watched more carefully, of course, than Jerusalem. Nowhere is it watched more anxiously either. Israel has a huge amount invested in the peace treaty with Egypt, signed in the 1970s. They've come to regard Hosni Mubarak as the kind of living embodiment of that peace treaty, as the guarantor of it. And there's huge anxiety about what will happen, not just immediately in Egypt from Israel's point of view. Who will take over? Is this a military coup? How long will the army run things? But also, what will happen in the longer term? Will a democratically elected Egyptian government of the future, for example, be under pressure from a sceptical population to take a harder line with Israel? So there are all sorts of questions here, and the Israeli government's basic view is that the best way to handle them for now is to say as little as possible in public.
In public, but behind the scenes, any sense of, do you have any sense of what will be going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think that they are hoping that this is what we're watching, is some kind of managed transition, that Hosni Mubarak has been abandoned now by rather similar people to himself who run the Egyptian armed forces, and that the hope will be that they will be interested not just in stability in the region, but in maintaining a good relationship with the United States. And, of course, the Egyptian army will only keep a good relationship with the United States if it keeps a good relationship with Israel. So there's cautious optimism here that if the people power revolution doesn't go too far, if the army can assert control, if stability can come back in the relatively near term, then some sort of workable arrangement from Israel's point of view may yet be possible.
And how is this being reported in Israel? Is this being covered minute by minute?
It's the subject of the same kind of intense scrutiny in Israel, the same sort of fascination in Israel that you would find anywhere else. But beneath it, of course, there is that extra dimension that Israelis are frankly very worried about this. Everybody knows that the peace deal with Egypt was the cornerstone of Israeli prosperity in many ways in the last 20, 30 years because it allowed them to cut defense spending. It anchored Israel in the region. It made it feel secure within its borders. So people here watch it and they see that it's a great historical and human drama, just like the rest of the world does, but there is an edge to the way it's watched in Israel because there is so much at stake for Israelis.
Kevin Connolly in Jerusalem, many thanks for updating us with the news from Israel. Here with me in the studio is the BBC Arabic service, Inez Eshmael. You heard their caution and anxiety in Jerusalem. How do you imagine things will be playing out?
You mean playing out in Egypt?
Yes.
Well, I would imagine that any government in Egypt, any new formed government, whether be it by the army or a civilian government, would have no interest to breach a peace treaty with Israel. In fact, any country in transition would try to secure its borders. That would be the first thing, so that it can focus on its internal stability. So I believe that this is not what's important to anybody in Egypt now. What's important to people in Egypt, whether people in the street or people in the army or people in any political party now, is how can we get this country back to normal. And by normal, I don't mean normal to how it was in the old regime. Normal as in a running country under a new government. And of course, the protesters themselves must be thinking about that now. I'm sure that many, many millions or hundreds of thousands would want to go home now and celebrate. But some of them would still be asking themselves, should we go home now? Should we actually ask for Omar Suleiman also to go? Should we ask for a clear assurance from the army about what will be next? Should we ask for trials for all figures of the old regime? So the questions are really many, but none of these questions now would be focused on their international policy or a peace treaty with Israel.
Right. BBC's Arabic service, Inez Eshmael, with me in the studio. But let's go back now to the heart of the protests in Egypt, to Tahrir Square, and our Arab affairs analyst, Magdi Abdul-Hadi, who's there.
Oh, hello, Claire. I'm not there yet, but I'm hoping to
You're
get there
there
as soon as traffic allows me to. But I can tell you, the moment the announcement was made on state television, we could hear the jubilation on the streets surrounding the building we were in, cars honking, women ululating. Cairo will not sleep tonight. The whole country, I should probably say, will not sleep tonight. This is by far one of the most historic moments in Egypt's modern history. It has never happened that Egyptians have persistently, tirelessly campaigned, broken old ways, old fears in the face of insurmountable difficulties, what many have regarded for years a police state, and broken that and managed to force a man they regarded as a dictator to step down. It's a huge step, will give enormous boosts to the confidence, the collective confidence of the people, and the fact that they can actually make things like this happen. It is just unprecedented. And of course, everybody will be focused on the immediate and the immediate future, how to manage a transition to a more democratic form of government.
And for those who aren't familiar with Egypt, they will have heard for a different Egypt over the last 2 weeks. This prior to 2 weeks ago, Egypt was a different place.
I was in Egypt in December, and there was a general mood of apathy hanging over the country, even individuals. People got tired of discussing Mubarak and his family. It was the uppermost political topic in everyone's mind. When will Mubarak die? Will his son Gamal succeed him? And is it at all possible to stop that from happening? And the general consensus was very unlikely. The best that people can hope for is General Omar Suleiman, who's the current vice president himself, comes from military, will somehow become the future president. But nobody ever dreamt that Egypt will actually manage to get rid of Mubarak in the way, in the dramatic and spectacular way, epic almost, that it has managed to do so far.
And they didn't dream of it, but they kept on coming. 18 days, and they kept on coming. And over the last 24 hours has obviously been the most dramatic. Remind us of what's been happening in the last few hours.
Well, in the last few hours, people, after President Mubarak's speech on Thursday evening, in which said he disappointed many people by saying that he's not planning to quit and he handed over some of his powers to his vice president, people were enormously disappointed and angry. And somehow that increased the people's resolve and determination to come out on the streets in even large numbers. He had planned to do so anyway, but the fact that he somehow challenged them, and they thought the speech was very defiant and showed little respect, if any, for the will of the people. And people came out in large numbers in Cairo and Alexandria, as far away as the south of Egypt in Asyut, determined to stay there and keep putting pressure. And for the first time, tens of thousands apparently marched onto the presidential palace to demand that president step down and step down immediately. A colleague who was there at the presidential palace, he said it was just an enormous cry of joy when the announcement was made at the palace. And he told me that it was actually the army who came out, or people from the Republican Guards, I would assume, would come out and made the announcement on a hala. And people just burst in joy and celebration. So this is history unfolding in the literal sense of the word. So people feel they've won, they've achieved something they've never, ever dreamt of achieving. And, of course, other countries will be watching closely. Mubarak was not the only Arab autocratic ruler. To the east, Libya, Colonel Gaddafi has ruled longer than Mubarak. Further to the east, there is, of course, Algeria. And to the north, east, Syria, another country with a very authoritarian regime. So the entire region, as well as the whole world, has been watching this, will continue to watch how what happened in Egypt and earlier in Tunisia will continue to reverberate across the Middle East.
Well, Magdi Abdul Hadi, our Arab Affairs analyst, will let you get down to the square now, and we can cross to John Simpson, who's on the streets of Cairo. John, what can you see?
Well, I'm in fact on the 17th floor of a large block of flats, and I'm looking down to a scene that, well, we certainly haven't seen in Cairo for nearly 3 weeks. The streets absolutely packed with vehicles and people shouting and chanting and blasting their horns, waving flags, and walking up and down the roads and dancing. It's the most extraordinary sight. And what we haven't had is the traffic jams, and the traffic jams are back. So Cairo's back to its old self again tonight.
So much like our Arab Affairs analyst Magdi Abdul Hadi, everyone's heading to the square.
Well, not really, no. I mean, people are just kind of demonstrating with joy wherever they are. There will be a lot of people in the square. I can see large numbers of people heading towards it now on a bridge down a little bit further along the Nile from where I am. But I think it's just really an occasion to get out in the car, blast your horn, and it doesn't really matter where you go.
Have you managed to speak to anyone about their reaction?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's difficult not to. People come and want to grab you and tell you what a fantastic moment it is. How they always knew he was going. I'm not sure that's entirely true. And what a moment for Egypt this is. And, you know, I mean, tomorrow is another day, but now the pure joy of having got a highly unpopular leader off their backs is something which just comes as a delight to everybody here, I think, or at least almost everybody.
John Simpson in Cairo, thanks very much. Let's go now to our diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, who's here with me in the studio. I'd just like to pick up on something our Arab affairs analyst, Magdi Abdul-Hadi, was saying about this being watched in the Arab region.
Well, absolutely. And we're beginning to get some reactions, at least from one Arab country, Tunisia. Remember the country that, in a sense, began this wave of unrest. 4 weeks now, pretty well after the Tunisians toppled their president. The AFP news agency is saying that Tunisians were dancing in the street when they heard about the resignation of the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak. Now, we're expecting other reactions. The American president is going to speak a little under 2 hours now, but we've already had a reaction from the European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton. She said she respected the Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak's decision to stand down and called for a dialogue for the formation of a broad-based government in Egypt. She said that the European Union shared the objective of the Egyptian people for an orderly transition to democracy and free and fair elections in the country. And interestingly, a snippet on the news agencies from the Israelis, no named figure coming out yet and speaking, but a government official again speaking to the AFP news agency. It's obviously the Friday evening in Israel, so the Jewish Sabbath, but a government official telling AFP that they hope that the departure of the Egyptian president will now be conducted, the transition will be conducted smoothly.
Let's just hear a little bit about what's going on in Tahrir Square. And BBC Arabic service, Inez Ishmael is here with me. You were saying to me, Egypt has become a big liberation square.
Absolutely, that people are not celebrating in Tahrir Square now. People are celebrating everywhere in Egypt. And Egypt now, after the 25th of January, has become a new Egypt. Another Egypt that was before the 25th of January. As we heard from Magdi Abdul-Hadi, there is this boost in the collective confidence of the people of Egypt that they can do something, that they went there for 18 days and they managed to change not just their present, they managed to change their future present and their future as a country and as the people of Egypt.
And let's remind ourselves that these protesters represent a myriad. They're from...
Absolutely. Some analysts say that there is a huge presence of this, of Muslim Brotherhood or a presence of this political party. In fact, those represent all of Egypt. The coalition of power that has been formed, 14 people represent this youth. They are from all directions. And this shows that it's not just one party or one political force that has a big or a central role in this uprising, if you can call it, or these demonstrations that managed to change the country. It's everybody. Everybody has participated. And the strongest part in this is the youth. The youth, their persistence and their innovation, the innovative ways that they managed to create in order to get all this crowd to the streets of Cairo, despite the fear, despite the apathy, despite everything, they managed to mobilize them and get them to choose their future.
I heard from a protester earlier today outside Egyptian state television. He was talking about his parents' generation and saying that they weren't convinced that the protesters were taking the right route. They watched Egyptian state television, they believe what Egyptian state television told them, but he was bringing them round and telling them this isn't true.
This is exactly my observation, that the older generation, the parents of those youth in the street, have always been dismissive of the ability of the youth, ability of the people to have a say in the future of this country. And it was their fear that has stopped this youth from saying their words for years. And now some of those youth are I don't want to say that they don't forgive their parents, but they are critical of their parents who have not taken this step earlier to say that in a democracy, in a country, it's the people that who should have their say, not the rulers, that the country is its people, not its rulers.
And you've been obviously following this story very much from the start. What for you was the most important point?
The most important point is a belief of someone that he can do something. That's one. Second, the social network sites, and the social network site is what got this message across to people and that has managed to get across the censorship of the media. It has come, it has managed to cross borders. Not so it, the this message and this belief did not only go inside Egypt. It went everywhere to Egyptians all around the world. And those Egyptians, not just the Egyptians in Egypt, managed to create this. And once this belief has started to really become a reality, not just a vision, people started to act on it. When they saw the people in Tunisia and what they managed to achieve when they protested in the street, they thought, that's my analysis, they thought that, yes, they can make it, and they did it.
BBC Arabic Service, Ines Ishmael with me here in the studio. But let's cross now to John Lyne, who is very close to Tahrir Square, I understand. John, whereabouts are you?
Well, I'm right on the edge of the square. If I was in the square, I just wouldn't be able to hear you, and you probably wouldn't be able to hear me because it is so loud in there. I've just walked a short distance to go in here. The whole of Cairo, as you might expect, has utterly erupted. Everyone has suddenly found an Egyptian flag from somewhere. Every car horn is hooting. Everybody's put their car radio on to the maximum volume with some music. People are letting off fireworks. We're hearing gunfire in the air. People are hugging each other. The military are being congratulated. People are going up and getting their photos taken. The military are being given children to hug and to kiss. And everybody, well, if President Mubarak, if we had any doubts about the unpopularity of President Mubarak, they have now been scotched. It's like the country feels like it has been liberated.
And there's been a fairly easy relationship between the people, the protesters, and the army throughout. But that has been key to this. How have the army been responding?
Well, the army have clearly done this. I mean, they've taken control, and I think in the cold light of dawn, once the celebrations are over, and that may be quite a way away yet, there will be a cold hard think about precisely how much they do love the army, because the Army High Council have taken control. It is a military coup, because the army have taken control and busted the constitution. Officially, the Speaker of Parliament should be in control. The military in charge, they've come out right in front. Now is a key moment. Are the military really committed to a transition to a proper democracy, or do they really want to entrench their power? But those are questions, I think, for tomorrow, next week and next month. For the moment, the crowd are absolutely just going crazy.
And I'm sorry, I was actually meaning the soldiers in the square. You say they've been handed babies. Obviously, they've had an important role to play over the past few...
Yeah, well, they played a slightly strange role here because they didn't come to the defence of the people in the square when they were attacked by these government thugs and shot at by government thugs. But they were there. They weren't certainly making the protesters go away. People had a degree of trust of the military here, but they were a bit wary of them. But the ordinary soldiers, yeah, people like them, and they get on well. They're seen as soldiers coming, an army coming from the people. Maybe people are a bit more sceptical about their commanders.
John Lyne in Tahrir Square, thanks very much. So, just a reminder, in the past half hour, 45, 50 minutes, the Egyptian Vice President Omar Suleiman announced that President Mubarak decided to step down from office and his powers would be taken over by the Army Council. This is how it went.
Mohammed Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from the office of President of the Republic and has charged the Higher Council of the Armed Forces to administer the affairs of the country. May God help everybody.
Well, our correspondent Caroline Hawley has been looking back at Hosni Mubarak's presidency. After 17 days of protests, it seemed like the moment had finally come. The Egyptian army hinted that President Mubarak was preparing to resign, and the mood on the street That was our correspondent, Maddie Savage. Let's now bring you Caroline Hawley, our correspondent who's been looking back at Hosni Mubarak's presidency.
It was amid turmoil that Hosni Mubarak became president when his predecessor Anwar Sadat was assassinated in 1981. A military man, stability was the obsession of his regime at the expense of human rights. For the West, his support for peace with Israel made him a pivotal ally. But he was violently opposed by Islamist extremists, and his rule was challenged by the Muslim Brotherhood, and more recently by a growing secular opposition fed up of police brutality, corruption, and autocratic rule. Inspired by the revolution in Tunisia, it was they who brought the people onto the streets. As unprecedented protests continued, President Mubarak made a series of concessions. All were too little, too late. His regime had lost its legitimacy, and it was only a matter of time before he had to go.
Our correspondent Caroline Hawley there. Well, the week of protests and disruption have put immense pressure on the Egyptian economy. So what will today's announcement about President Mubarak's resignation mean? I'm joined now in the studio by our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. Andrew, remind us, how much of an impact this has had, 18 days of protests?
It has been a really quite substantial impact. A lot of people have not been going to work at various stages in this in these protests. So that means that many businesses have not been getting revenue. Either people haven't been turning up on the day or customers haven't been coming through the door. But at the same time, they've been having to pay rent, electricity and so forth. So it's been a serious problem for many businesses. In particular, of course, tourism. Has been very severely affected. Many holiday makers have been put off as a result of the turmoil, and so many went home early. Now, earlier on this week, there was a bit of a return somewhat towards normal. One analyst described it to me as the Egyptian economy getting back to flying on three engines out of a possible four. But we're still a long way back from full normality. But provided these latest developments do give us some degree of political stability for a period, and provided the demonstrators are happy enough about what's happened, then at least the business of getting Egypt back to work could take place fairly quickly.
And stock markets react quickly usually. Have we seen anything yet?
Yes, it's been broadly received favourably on international markets. Some stock markets are a little higher, and we've also seen the price of oil come down, which is quite interesting. What's happening there is that oil was up because of fears about possible disruption to the Suez Canal, an important transit route for oil, both through the canal and through an adjacent pipeline. The fact that there is some sign of an improvement in the political situation, I think, has dispelled those fears to some extent. But I would emphasise how the markets see things may well change in the coming hours and days. Just depends on whether this degree of political calm is maintained for a longer period.
Our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, there. Thanks very much. Well, Jonathan Marcus, our diplomatic correspondent, is still here in the studio with me. Jonathan, what do you make of what we've heard in the past hour?
Well, it's an extraordinary upheaval for Egypt. It's potentially an extraordinary upheaval for the region as a whole. It throws so many questions forward about where Egypt itself is going to go, the process of transition, the role of the military, where else perhaps, where next, where might be influenced by these dramatic events. We're hearing a lot about the generational changes and differences in Egypt. One member of the older generation, I'm sure he won't mind me calling him that, the Nobel Peace Laureate, Mohamed El Baradei, who obviously returned to Cairo long before these disturbances in the hope of organising a new political force in the country. He's been speaking to one of the news agents. He's described today as the greatest day of my life. He said the country has been liberated after decades of repression, and he said that he expected a beautiful transition of power. I think if it's really beautiful and peaceful, many, 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 many more people than just him will be mightily relieved.
Absolutely. And any more reaction? Have we had any more reaction yet? Are we expecting to hear from President Obama within an hour and a half or so?
Yes, indeed. A little more from Qatar in the Gulf. They've said that it's a positive, important step towards the Egyptian people's aspirations of achieving democracy. So from the Gulf, a green light on the what they see as the positive developments on the streets of Cairo.
Thanks very much, Jonathan Marcus. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Claire Bowes. Just a reminder, this is a special world briefing bringing you news about the developments in Egypt, where the Vice President Omar Suleiman has announced that President Hosni Mubarak has decided to step down from office and his powers taken over by the Army Council.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Before I get rolling with the numbers, a quick programming note. At 11:06, Focus will return, and we will continue our Talk to the Managers segment. So be sure to call on in beginning at 11:06. Let's look at the particulars as we head into the final hours of trading for this week. In Kansas City, March wheat 970¾, up 2¾. July 991, up 3¾. March wheat at the board.